Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, December 1, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the Siege of Aleppo and war crimes. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we welcome our experts, Professor Lori Blank, who is the Director of International Humanitarian Law Clinic at Emory Law School. We also have with us Professor Mike Newton, who is the Director of the Vanderbilt in Venice program at Vanderbilt University Law School. Today I will turn it over to Lori to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for audience questions, so please think of questions you would like to ask our experts. Professors, thank you both for speaking with us. Lori, the floor is yours.
Wonderful. Thanks, Nate. Thank you so much for having me for this session today, and I look forward to an interesting discussion with my good friend, Professor Newton. Unfortunately, of course, it would be better if we had a happier topic to discuss, but I think that's, of course, one of the reasons why it's so important. So what I'd like to do for a few minutes here to get the conversation started is give some frame of reference for what we're talking about when we talk about war crimes and other international crimes going on in Aleppo. There's no doubt that what we're looking at from afar is, you know, one of the most extraordinary disasters I think that human beings could describe. It certainly just seems to get worse and worse every day, no matter what angle you look at it. So when we talk about war crimes, what we're talking about are violations of the law of armed conflict. And so I'd like to just give a little bit of background there. The law of armed conflict is, as its name suggests, the body of international law that applies during a situation of armed conflict, or to use a more colloquial word, war. And we'll get into some other broader criminal law issues beyond the law of armed conflict, but I just want to use this as a framework and then highlight some of the key crimes that are and atrocities that are being committed so that we can actually break them out and think about the different problems that are going on and how they are contributing all together to this humanitarian catastrophe. So the law of armed conflict is focused on a couple of things. One is the regulation of the conduct of hostilities between two or more parties to an armed conflict with the goal of minimizing suffering during wartime, predominantly for civilians, that is those who are not fighting. And it also seeks to protect whole categories of people, both those who are fighting and those who are not during wartime. So it provides a number of different rules and principles that guide warring parties in terms of how they can actually conduct attacks and military operations in the course of war, how they need to treat people who fall into their hands and into their custody during armed conflict, what they need to do in terms of ensuring that people have access to humanitarian assistance, to medical care, how people must be treated when they are in occupied territory or in the hands of an enemy party, what happens when enemy soldiers are captured, and so on and so forth. And again, the focus here really is on balancing the two essential considerations that lie at the heart of the law of war, the law of armed conflict. And those are military necessity, the military needs of the warring parties, and humanity, the humanitarian focus of protecting people and minimizing suffering during wartime. And in all situations, we see this delicate balance being carried out all the time. So when we think about what's going on in Aleppo, we have a range of categories of war crimes and other crimes. And I should start by saying that the term war crime refers specifically to a violation of the law of armed conflict. We have two other categories of international crimes that are also raised by the situation in Syria and in Aleppo, and they are crimes against humanity and genocide. And we tend to hear about these periodically, of course. We heard about the genocide with the Yazidis and potentially other ethnic groups in Syria. And it's important to know that both crimes against humanity and genocide are crimes that can be committed during wartime or outside of wartime. You do not have to have a war going on in order to find those crimes being committed. With war crimes, you need that initial threshold element that there is an armed conflict going on. I know that my colleague, Professor Newton, is going to talk with us a bit about accountability issues in this area of international criminal law. So I will leave some of those questions to him. But when we think about international criminal law, this is a body of law that is, of course, closely tied to the law of armed conflict because it is the law and the legal regime by which people are held individually, criminally accountable for crimes that they commit during armed conflict. One of the most important things about this body of law, the law that applies during wartime, is that it's not only states or rebel groups or other armed groups, however you want to describe them, that are responsible in some group or collective notion for atrocities and other violations that are committed. It is a critically important fundamental principle that individuals, men and women, individual persons, leaders, soldiers, rebel fighters, civilians, anybody, are accountable for their acts that constitute crimes during armed conflict. And this is critically important to help ensure that we break the cycle of collective violence, of looking at groups as responsible for crimes, and ensuring that individuals are held responsible for their acts. So as we look at the categories of war crimes, let me highlight several of them. So one, we see deliberate attacks on civilians. This violates what is probably the most fundamental tenet of the law of armed conflict, which is the principle of distinction. The principle of distinction says that if you're fighting in a conflict, you need to distinguish between soldiers or fighters on the other side and the civilians who are not involved in the fighting, and that you can only attack persons who are involved in the fighting. So the soldiers for the other side, the members of the armed group, etc. And that any deliberate attacks on civilians are prohibited. This, of course, is the first line of effort in carrying out the fundamental purpose of the law of armed conflict to protect civilians during armed conflict. Unfortunately, we see quite a lot of evidence of deliberate attacks on civilians and civilian objects and specially protected objects in Aleppo and in other areas of Syria. And, to the extent that evidence that is being collected, documentation that is going on, bears out what seems to be quite obvious as we watch from, in the news, I think there are quite a lot of war crimes of deliberate attacks going on. A second category is indiscriminate attacks. And here, what the law says is that it's not only that you must refrain from deliberately and intentionally attacking someone who is protected during armed conflict, a civilian, someone who is not involved in the fighting, but you also have to take care to make sure that you are not launching attacks that pay no attention to who actually is going to end up being the object of attack. There's a couple of different ways indiscriminate attacks can actually be carried out. One is based on the means used, that is the type of weapon used, and the other is if in launching the attack you simply pay no attention to whether you are attacking a civilian population center, combatants and fighters for the other side, a mix, that you simply just launch your weapons and don't really pay any attention or don't care whether or not you are distinguishing in any manner. We see both of these going on in Aleppo. We think about the types of weapons that are being used. You've probably heard about the barrel bombs. These are exactly what they sound like, barrels filled with shrapnel and explosive and metal pieces and all kinds of things dropped from helicopters and other aircraft, and they can't be guided in any way to a target. They explode, and obviously there's no way to control the blast radius, the effects of these bombs. And these are really, I think, a classic example of an indiscriminate weapon. And we also see firing into neighborhoods where there may be opposition fighters and also civilians seeking safety, and doesn't seem to be any effort in terms of trying to discriminate, that is, distinguish between who might be considered the enemy as in a suitable target for attack and who is a civilian who needs to be protected. A third category has to do with the use of chemical weapons, which we've heard many reports about from different parts, including in Aleppo. And here we have a flat-out prohibition on the use of chemical weapons in any type of armed conflict for any reason whatsoever. There simply is never a situation in which chemical weapons are acceptable. And so, unfortunately, we have had many examples of that reported as well. The next three categories of crimes that I want to talk about are the ones I think that have gotten some of the most attention and are really highlighting the truly horrific nature of what is going on right now in Aleppo and more broadly in Syria. First, we have deliberate attacks on hospitals. As of the last report that I saw of the last day or two, there are no hospitals left in Aleppo. There is an emergency trauma center that doesn't have the capabilities to handle some more difficult situations, but there are no hospitals left at all. And this is, of course, just an unmitigated and really indescribable disaster, because think of all the different types of people, not just people who are wounded in the course of the fighting, but even just folks who need to have medical care for any reason, they have nowhere to go. It's particularly problematic in the context of the law of armed conflict because the modern law of armed conflict, the treaty law in the framework of the Geneva Conventions, rests upon a foundation of the very first Geneva Convention in 1864, which was focused on access and the provision of medical care during armed conflict. That is really where this law starts, with the idea that people who are wounded in the course of battle need to be cared for, and that warring parties need to allow access to neutral and impartial humanitarian organizations to provide that care, and that they also need to provide care to wounded personnel from either side who are within their custody or control. Unfortunately, we see exactly the opposite going on in Aleppo. Not only do we not see efforts to provide medical care to persons who are harmed, wounded, sick, etc., in the course of the conflict, we see actually deliberate attempts to eliminate any possibility of medical care whatsoever. The law of armed conflict specifically protects hospitals from attack, from any interference, and requires that they be respected and protected during armed conflict. And here we have deliberate attacks on hospitals. The other two related categories in terms of acts that have particularly damaged the fabric of civilian life beyond what the fighting has done is the denial of access for humanitarian relief, whether by the United Nations or the International Committee of the Red Cross, or other humanitarian relief organizations. The law of armed conflict mandates that civilian population have access to humanitarian relief and requires that states and other parties to a conflict either provide that relief or provide access. In general, they can refuse access as long as there is good reason. That could often, for example, be that there is fighting going on nearby and they're not able to provide security. However, such consent cannot be withheld arbitrarily and certainly cannot be withheld in an attempt to starve the civilian population, which is what we see going on in Aleppo and other areas. The third of these related categories are attacks on humanitarian relief convoys. I'm sure you all are familiar with the attack that occurred earlier this fall on a major UN humanitarian relief convoy. It is believed that Russian aircraft and Syrian aircraft bombed it directly. Of course, they have contested that. At present, the UN is seeking to institute a board of inquiry into this incident. Again, the law flatly prohibits this, and it is a war crime under the International Criminal Court and other customary and treaty law to deliberately attack a humanitarian relief convoy. What these last two categories then point to is another category of war crime, which is the starvation of civilians as a weapon of war. So historically, it's certainly been common or at least accepted to use siege warfare as a tactic to when bombardment and other attacks may not achieve the objective of dislodging the enemy from a city or other area. However, it is prohibited to use starvation of civilians as a weapon of war. And so what we see going on is the deliberate destruction of what we would call objects indispensable to the survival of the civilian population, whether that be food stores, access to water, other shelter, anything else. A siege can only be directed at combatants and other persons who are fighting. And what we see going on certainly in Aleppo and in a few other cities that in Syria that have been under siege is an effort to starve out the civilian population as a way to gain control of that area. So I think what I'd like to do is turn the floor over to my colleague, Professor Newton. And I know he has a lot of thoughts for us in terms of questions about accountability, which are very difficult in this situation. So, Mike, I turn it over to you.
No, thanks, Laurie. So those are some nice framing thoughts, just to sort of go over the big pictures of the range of offenses. Those are things where both Laurie and I are prepared to talk in some detail, and if people are interested, can give the specific citations of the law that support each of those assertions. The primary principle is that civilians and non-combatants are protected to the greatest extent possible from the effects of hostilities. What we're seeing in Aleppo in particular, and really throughout the entire Syrian civil war for almost 6 years now, is exactly the opposite, where people really have put civilians and civilian objects at the very center of the military effort. What I want to do is set up sort of a bit more of the strategic backdrop of how we got where we are, which helps us understand the way ahead. The Russians have called any UN Security Council efforts. The Security Council met just yesterday in an emergency session, calling for a cessation of hostilities and trying to plot the way ahead. The Russians dismissed that as just a propaganda campaign. In fact, the strategic objective of both the Russians and their Syrian allies is to have a strategic acceleration so that Aleppo can finally be conquered. The Russians have said this is a fight for the city, and in their mind, it's a fight for the city for two reasons that began now. One was because of the U.S. election. They've made direct reference to the U.S. election and an incoming administration that would presumably take a reexamination of U.S. policy in Syria. So they want to get Aleppo off the map in terms of being in government control before any new administration has the chance to reassert control and change policies. And the other thing is that Aleppo really is the center of the backbone of the longstanding rebel resistance. Now, what I want to do is approach things in terms of the macro and the micro strategic. What the Russians are really doing and the Syrian regime in Aleppo is using civilian suffering as a strategic end game. At the macro level, that's because they've essentially engaged in a public relations campaign and called everything terrorism. And there are technical terms within the law. Civilians directly participating in hostilities would be one, or unprivileged belligerents would be another. The law has categories of persons into which we put people. In the law of war, we don't simply dismiss and say, well, they're all terrorists, and therefore they have no rights. They can be bombed. They can be killed indiscriminately. We can use barrel bombs against them or chemical weapons because they're terrorists. That's not what the law of war permits. The law of war is, in the memorable phrase of Yoram Denstein, it's a parallelogram of forces. There's always the demands of military necessity, and the idea that the law is an instantiating force that permits people to wage war effectively and win. It's not a violation of the law of war to fight to win. It is a violation of the law of war, though, to fight to win in an unlawful way, either using unlawful weapons or directing hostilities against persons who are supposed to be safe. So this idea that we can just cast a broad brush and say everybody who opposes a regime is a terrorist, and therefore I can dehumanize them, I can use indiscriminate weapons, I can intentionally attack civilians, as Laurie said, in violation of the principle of distinction. Those things are all permissible because we can just dismiss them as terrorists. That's just legally incorrect. And you need look no further to really sniff out what's going on than to look at what the UN has consistently said. Anybody fighting in good faith would accept these principles. The UN has said, special representative, that what needs to happen in Aleppo is an immediate cessation of attacks to allow for medical evacuations of civilians, delivery of medical supplies, provision of food, and you know, the rotation of doctors. Well, why do you need doctors and medical supplies? Because the Russians have intentionally bombed every hospital in Aleppo, one by one by one. They've intentionally bombed the bases of the famous White Helmets, who are the emergency civil defenders who rush in to try to save people and dig them out of rubble and protect them. They've intentionally hit those very life-saving forces that are in the city working and trying to keep people alive and trying to get people fed. They've intentionally, as Laurie said, hit the humanitarian relief convoys that have been coordinated. It's the exact opposite of doing everything feasible to minimize or eliminate civilian casualties or attacks against unlawful targets. Now, that's the macro level. At the micro level, the Russians are sort of having both ways. The reason there's not ICC jurisdiction, which, for those who may not know, the International Criminal Court, has no jurisdiction in Syria because the treaty does not apply by its very terms in Syria. There's a provision in the statute, in Article 13, that allows ICC jurisdiction to be created when the Security Council approves. And, of course, you guessed it if you follow the news on this. The reason the Russians at present are free to commit such war crimes with no ICC accountability structure in place is precisely because the Russians vetoed that resolution. And part of the reason they did that was they said, well, this is just about eliminating terrorists. Well, yeah, there's a lot of terrorists. There's a lot of real terrorists in Syria that there is Security Council authority to target using under the laws of war. But that does not include the entire population of Aleppo. And that's the false paradigm that they have created in order to justify these kinds of strikes. So what we have today is a massive military offensive going on the ground, even while in the international forums, the Russians continually say, we want to find a peaceful solution. We want to restore democracy. We want to restore order and peace and calm. That's the exact opposite of what's going on the ground. And, you know, if people are interested, we can talk about the mechanics of what a war crimes accountability process would look like. We can talk about the law of command responsibility that allows you to impose accountability on certain actors. There's a lot of things to talk about. I'm just not sure where people would like the conversation to go, because Laurie and I both have many more thoughts on this. Laurie, was there something you wanted to add in?
Well, I'm happy to talk a bit about how we categorize persons during armed conflict, because the claim, as you say, that everybody is a terrorist and every action is being done to combat terrorists is, of course, remarkably overbroad and highly problematic in the way we think about the law and the way the law works. So if that would be useful in advance of questions, perhaps I will just take a couple of minutes to do that. So I'll start by saying that the word terrorist is not a legal term of art, certainly not in the law of war. It is predominantly a political term. And I think we can affirm this when we realize that there are, I believe it's 109 different definitions of terrorism internationally, and multiple definitions within the U.S. government alone. So while it is a useful word in describing someone who uses violence against civilians for a political purpose, it's not a term in the law of war. And instead, what the law of war does is it basically divides people into two categories. There are persons who are fighting, and there are persons who are not fighting. When we talk about a conflict between two states, persons who are fighting are generally called combatants. That's a term that refers to the members of the armed forces of a state. They are presumed to be lawful fighters, lawful belligerents in the conflict they're fighting on behalf of their state. In general, anybody else is going to be a civilian. That's that starting point for how we think about the principle of distinction that I mentioned that seeks to protect civilians during conflict. In the context of a conflict like that in Syria, which is what we call a non-international armed conflict, so a conflict in which a state is fighting one or more non-state groups, or maybe multiple non-state groups are fighting against each other, Syria is like a diagrammer's dream in trying to put all the pieces into a diagram. But what we do know is that we don't have two states fighting actually against each other. So in that context, we generally would use the term fighters or members of organized armed group to describe people who are fighting for any type of non-state entity. And everybody else who's not fighting, we call them civilians. Now, if a civilian decides to take part in the hostilities, to pick up a gun and fight or do something that is the equivalent of that, then they will lose their protection from attack. So a civilian who doesn't actually join the military or join an armed opposition group, but actually is engaged in fighting in some way, will not be protected during the time he or she is fighting from direct attack. That is really a common sense rule that essentially is linked to the basic notion of self-defense, that if you have someone shooting at you, you should be able to defend yourself and take action against them. Now, those are the terms of art, in essence. By using the term terrorist, what we see is the Syrian regime and the Russian government essentially muddying the waters and trying to lump everybody into a group of and I would put quotes around this, really bad people, right? They're so bad that we can attack them, we can deny them medical care, we can deny them access to food and water and anything else because they're as bad as it gets. Again, this runs counter to every fundamental notion of the law of armed conflict, of international law in general. And as Mike said, really is sort of the rhetorical tool that's being used to, if not justify, at least gloss over the types of attacks that the regime and their Russian friends are engaging in.
Well, let me pick up there. I mean, and because there's such a discrepancy between what the law absolutely clearly requires, and I think it's important for people to understand that the law of war is one of the most, if not the most, well-developed, deeply entrenched body of law in all of international law, going back centuries. You know, the rules, for example, on the treatment of prisoners of war go back to the Greek and Roman era. The roots of that can be traced. So it's, the treaties themselves, as they've evolved, have grown up around a very widespread and very deeply entrenched set of state practice. And the idea of it all is that it operates, even in the most difficult circumstances, as a constraint, as a hard binding normative framework that is always applicable in one form or the other. So what the Russians are essentially doing is denying that centuries-old history. You know, the Russian foreign minister sat in the UN Security Council at the very end of September, and he said, Russia has consistently advocated an exclusively peaceful solution. At the exact same time on the ground, deliberate and intentional attacks are ongoing with Russian air power and in support of a Syrian offensive on the ground. To decisively end the siege of Aleppo by just destroying it. The Russians are essentially acting as if this is Stalingrad 1942 and it's total war. Well, that's a violation on so many levels of the law. And there's just no moral equivalence between an occasional violation and a deliberate widespread pattern of intentional violations, which is what we're seeing on the ground. We've seen that from the regime for a very long time. Throughout the Civil War, but now what we're seeing is with the support and literally the overwatch of the Russians, you're seeing a deliberate acceleration of that, and that's the fundamental problem in terms of international law. The bigger strategic problem, I think, which is should be of great concern to every American, and in particular to anybody who cares about national security or cares about the region. You know, the United States had a window where we had some strategic latitude to take action and solve the conflict. There was a time window where the Russians were sidelined in relative terms. That window closed, after which chemical weapons use began to be deliberate and the Russians intentionally stepped in to intervene. So the problem today is, I don't care what course of action that you take, you cannot achieve peace on the ground without the Russians being involved. That strategic window that we had has closed. So the Russians say they're for peace, even at the exact same time as they're carrying out a massive military offensive. And it leaves decision makers in a very difficult spot. I mean, one thing I've heard suggested is that what the West should have done, and it's probably too late now, although it might not be too late, the high-risk, high-reward strategy was to have done an Aleppo airlift on a modern parallel to the Berlin airlift, you know, with full notice and lots of media disclosure, say we're flying in humanitarian supplies and we're going to land at the airport and put in some new doctors this time. Now, that's a confrontational policy. The problem is that the Russians have stood in the way of any real efforts to facilitate both humanitarian relief or food supplies or anything else. You know, the civilians on the ground in Aleppo basically are trying to drink whatever foul water they can find because the Russians have bombed the water stations. They're either going to starve or they're going to die of dehydration or they're going to die in bombs or they're going to get up and leave. And when they try to leave, you know, in many cases, they're turned back or they're killed as they're trying to leave. So it's a no-win situation. People on the ground say it's like living in an upside-down world, and that's the problem. And against the backdrop of all that, what the United States has said in late October in the Human Rights Council, we said an appropriate statement, but it sounds so feeble in light of what's going on the ground. We said we reiterate our call for an immediate end to all violations, and that's about as strong as we said it. And we reiterate our call for accountability. Well, that's the most self-obvious platitude that there is. The law of war is being violated on a massive scale, and there should be accountability. Of course. The question is how to achieve that. And there is, as far as I know, no concrete strategic plan right now to move towards real accountability or really effectively ending the ongoing war crimes. And that's the correct term. We can call it what we want. We can dance around it. But these are war crimes. These are deliberate war crimes. And that's the problem.
Let me raise one other issue that we haven't discussed, and that is the attacks on journalists and the attempts to control and stifle the flow of information. And this began very early on in Syria and, of course, has continued in Aleppo and in other areas. And so as a starting point, journalists are civilians. They are protected from attack. The fact that they might report a story that a government or other party to a conflict does not like in no way undermines their basic protection as a civilian during armed conflict. And we saw really starting from early on in the conflict in Syria that the Syrian regime was taking deliberate steps not only to control the flow of information, whether by cutting off internet access, by other non-forceful measures, but by the more, let's call it straightforward, and I mean that in a negative way here, tactic of simply attacking journalists directly. Marie Colvin and some of her colleagues were deliberately attacked. She was killed. There is actually a court case being brought against Syria here in U.S. court growing out of that incident for wrongful death. But the deliberate attacks on journalists, of course, is the war crime of intentional attack on civilians. There's not a lot of confusion in that regard, but it raises a larger question, which is an effort to eliminate the ability of the outside world to understand what's going on, to eliminate the ability of those who are fighting to survive, fighting against the regime, suffering, et cetera, to be able to get the story out to the world. And it's critically important in any of these situations to, first of all, get accurate information out to the outside world. And there have been any number of countless extraordinarily courageous individuals who have sought to do that, whether it's photographs or other documentation or videos or information from Aleppo, from other cities and other areas of Syria, to get that out to the outside world so that we can actually see what is going on. But, you know, when we see a pattern of deliberate attacks on journalists, it's particularly insidious because it shows the lengths to which the particular regime, in this case the Syrian regime, of course, will go in order to prevent information and control the story and the rhetoric and the narrative of what is going on. And the efforts of groups like the documentation groups to gather information are critically important because someday somebody is going to face accountability. It's going to be very challenging in Syria because of, the role of Russia as a serious ally, the jurisdictional challenges with the International Criminal Court, and so many other questions, but somebody is going to face accountability. And the documentation that is being carefully gathered and protected is going to be critical. So I wanted to highlight the importance of thinking about the information and the flow of information and the tactics of governments or other groups to try to curtail that is particularly problematic.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is a place where, I've been involved in some of those efforts in terms of collecting specific evidence for specific trials. We can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt war crimes trials are not based on Yahoo News releases. They're not based on – so attacking journalists is the first step towards a complete shutdown and a complete focused goal of not only preventing the creation of accountability mechanism, but even if there is an accountability mechanism we create. And there are ways of overcoming the jurisdictional challenges, even when the ICC sits on the sidelines. But you still have to have admissible trial evidence. You still have to have some witnesses who are alive who haven't been killed. You still have to have some records of the Russian lines of command in conjunction with the Syrian lines of command and orders and eyewitnesses who can testify to what happened and when. And the governments of the world not only have done a really poor job of stopping crimes on the ground, but they've also done what one can only say a lackluster job, an unenthusiastic job of actually, through concerted, comprehensive government action, government decision-making, collecting that kind of detailed evidence. So what they've done is they've left the field open to private efforts, to non-governmental efforts, and to me that's one of the biggest failings here in the big picture. And that's against the backdrop once we allow the strategic initiative to shift to the Russians and the Syrian regime. A new administration comes in with a new UN ambassador, and, there's a chance to begin to reclaim that, but things have so far degraded at this point that it's very difficult. And in the meantime, it cannot be overemphasized, the horrific human tragedy on the ground in Syria. 7 children dying a day, people living like what the Russians are doing in the Syrian regime in Aleppo really is the equivalent of medieval-style warfare. They're waging total war against everybody deemed to be on the other side. And that violates every tenet of modern international law. And so in the face of that, to sit back as a concerted set of Western governments based on rule of law and say, well, there's nothing that can really be done, violates every tenet of modern international law. So it's not just the law of war that's at stake here. In the larger sense, what we really are talking about is the systematic integrity of the international legal regime. And the Russians have set out to challenge that on a number of fronts, but most visibly and with the most enduring human consequences, that's what you're seeing in Aleppo. And so it's not too melodramatic, I don't think. If I thought it was melodramatic, I wouldn't say it. But the future of the international order really is, in some sense, endangered on the ground in Aleppo today. And unless we want to revert back to not a Cold War anymore, a real hot shooting war, where the only way of ensuring compliance and bringing order is absolute military victory on the ground, then we've got to find and step up to the plate and find a coherent strategic response to stop what's going on the ground. Because right now, the Russians and the Syrian regime has the strategic initiative. And we've completely surrendered. To go back to Clausewitz, they're on the offensive. And so we, so far, have been feckless in driving the pace of events on the ground. We've made all the right statements. Samantha Power's statement in the UN is excellent. The United States statement to the Human Rights Council is in Geneva is excellent, but so far what we've done is words. And in the meantime, civilians are dying on the ground. Civilians who have been intentionally targeted in violation of the laws of war, using indiscriminate weapons, day after day after day, airstrike after airstrike after airstrike. And what we've done so far is wring our hands. That's a problem.
Let me pick up on two points there. The first one is perhaps not the most encouraging perspective, but one of the challenges with international law generally, I'm sure, Mike, you get the same question. You know, it's often viewed as not really law, it's not effective, it's, you know, pie in the sky, et cetera. Well, of course, that's the farthest thing from the truth. It is, in fact, law. It's been around for many centuries. And, in fact, I would point you to oftentimes to Russia's rhetoric to show that it's actually couching what it's doing in the language of international law, which I think is evidence that it views it as the framework in which we all operate and we all judge the legitimacy of action. Of course, what they do is manipulate facts and information and legal rules to make it look as if what they're doing is acceptable. But nonetheless, they are not discounting the law altogether, and I think that's an important point. The flip side of that, however, is we have to remember that international law is always going to come up against power politics. International law is not a supranational hierarchical system. If you think back, it used to be called the law of nations. This is a totally horizontal system in which nation states find a way to engage with each other, to resolve disputes, to seek means of cooperation. And there is no supreme body. So ultimately, we will push up against power politics at times, and of course that's what we're seeing in terms of Russian action at the UN Security Council and in general. So that's certainly a frustrating point here. The second thing that I want to raise is when we talk about war crimes and the importance of documentation and the challenges, it's important to distinguish between the type of discussion that we're having here or in the news, as Mike said, in which we can identify what clearly appear to be war crimes and graver international crimes, whether it's crimes against humanity or genocide. But when we, if and when we ever get to an accountability process, remember that that is a criminal trial. And it starts with the basic premise that we, of course, start with here in the United States, which is that someone is innocent until proven guilty. That means that the prosecution, whether it's at the ICC or any other tribunal, needs to prove all the elements of any given crime. So even if we all know that attacks on hospitals occurred deliberately in Aleppo, the prosecution has to prove each element of that. And that's where all the documentation of actually what happened, who was harmed, who did it, what might be the evidence that points to their intent so we can show it was deliberate, that it was intentional, and so on. That's where all this information that the world wants, that the people in Syria are trying to get out, and, of course, the regime is trying to, put a lid on, becomes so critically important. The same way that we want the rule of law to govern in the context of the armed conflict, we need the rule of law to govern in the courtroom. And so, of course, that requires that a prosecutor meet that test of proving beyond a reasonable doubt. And it just, only strengthens the need to gather information, make sure that information gets to as many sources as possible, whether to courts or NGOs or governments or anybody else, so that it can be used as effectively as possible in the accountability process.
Yeah, and let me add to that. I said earlier that the law of war duty is to take all feasible measures to do what's possible given the military realities on the ground. This is one of the things that courts often struggle with, is that the law of war already embeds in its very fabric the necessary proper latitude for commanders and for people on the ground to do what's militarily appropriate and what's in the larger interests of military efficiency and winning the war. But at the very same time, it clearly defines the outer boundaries of permissible conduct. And so it's this very finely crafted set of body of rules that in some way have equal and opposing force, so that commanders or people on the ground or decision makers or even the Russian foreign minister are not at liberty to artificially inject some self-created, self-fulfilling legal imperative that's not already found in the bodies of the law. So within the law of command responsibility, every commander at all levels, and by extension in the modern law of superior responsibility, every civilian leader for the forces under their effective control has the binding duty at all times and in all places to do what's necessary to prevent or repress violations. That's the language of the law. And what we do is that we assume that commanders are going to act reasonably, and when they are acting reasonably and in good faith, the law gives them a wide range of discretion. So what we're really talking about is very focused efforts to document and to prove the violations of law where commanders have no permissible band of discretion and have therefore acted inappropriately and unlawfully. And to reiterate, the intentional targeting and the intentional starvation of civilians in no way can be condoned under the laws of war, which is why accountability is so important at this point. And that might be in the ICC. The ICC might have a role at some point, but at best that would only be for a very small minority of offenders. So what we really need to see is a full bore, full front effort at all levels to create and to document crimes and to create appropriate accountability. So many of these crimes are in fact subject to the domestic prosecution in other states and already established courts. You could easily see the creation of a regional tribunal, for example, convened in Erbil under the Kurdish regional government. That's a possibility. You could easily see the creation of some more higher-level regional tribunal structured along the lines of what we did in the Sierra Leone Special Court. Any of those things, and I would actually say all of those things, need to happen, because there's such a wide range of offenses, and the offenses being committed, the war crimes being committed on the ground, are so wide scale and so egregious and so deliberate that it really does challenge the very nature of the law of war to just allow them to be committed flagrantly and intentionally with no accountability whatsoever. And it's funny, because when you talk to warfighters about this, when you talk to the Peshmerga or other warfighters, they say, don't bother us with accountability. We're busy fighting the war. Well, let me ask you this. And any political official who really wants to defeat ISIS and who really wants to find a lasting peaceful solution in Syria, allowing the Syrian government narrative to continue unchallenged, how does that possibly create a long-term, peaceful, stable resolution of the conflict? In fact, it undermines it. And the courtroom and the clear mandates of the laws of war is one of the most powerful ways of rebutting this false narrative that the Syrians and the Russians are trying to create. And we have to keep saying that. The U.S. has said it. Our Western allies, the Brits and the French, have said it. But saying it won't really change the narrative. What has to be done is effective prosecutions. And that's why I started with the idea that we cannot allow the Russians to draw moral equivalence between, say, the U.S. attack in Kunduz, where we did a full public investigation. We pinpointed the precise source of human error and what they're doing. It's a false equivalence. And to the extent that we allow them to just blanket over with just rhetoric and propaganda and create this false moral equivalence, what we're really doing in the long run is undermining the laws of war. And that's why it matters so much that we do get accountability, that we do investigate, that we do prosecute, and that we make a public international commitment not to rest until that's done. I mean, it's non-negotiable. If you care about the law of war, these war crimes must be punished. I remember we were investigating in the Milosevic case, and I'm interviewing a particular witness who said, you know, what's the point? This will never be used. And we assured her, yes, ma'am, we're doing good faith investigations here. There will be an accountability mechanism. Your evidence is important, and it was important. In the real world, her statement was used in the Milosevic case. That's why, at the end of the day, there must be some accountability for these actions in the long term. And that can take any number of – there's a bunch of conceptual ways we could do that. But talking about it will not get it done. And if all we do is talk after what's happened on the ground in Aleppo, the law of war is seriously undermined in the long term. That's my fear.
Well, Mike and Lori, this is Nate. We've covered a lot of ground, and I've learned a great deal. But I do want to check in with our audience just to ensure that if they have any questions, we get to them before the end of our time. So I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your phone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Okay, it looks like we have two people in the queue. Let's go to the first audience question now.
Good afternoon. I've long been concerned that we are a destructive force in the Middle East. Under the policies of President Obama and Secretaries Clinton and Kerry, I think the Arab Spring has been a disaster in places like Iraq and Libya and Egypt, and I think it'd be a disaster in Syria too. It seems like folks in that part of the world can only have some semblance of peace under the boot of a dictator, preferably a secular dictator, to keep the terrorists and the crazies at bay. And our policy of regime change has been destructive in that manner. And I'm not suggesting the Russians are necessarily the good guys, if we are the bad guys, in fact. But I wonder, does any of that color our view, or should it color our view of what the Russians are doing or trying to do, even if they're going about some of it inappropriately?
Well, this is Mike Newton. That's a really good question, because what it says is, in the larger sense, what's the strategic endgame here? And to the extent that the Obama administration early on said, you know, they sort of played at both ends against the middle, and they said, well, Assad must go. He won't remain in power. So that seemed to be our strategic posture, which begs the question, what do you replace that with? What is your strategic vision for the region? And more importantly, at a pragmatic level, I think the real question is, how does that strategic vision advance U.S. interests? And in a larger sense, advance international legal interests, and the stability of civilian population and free markets and all the stuff that we want to achieve. We had a window where we could have done that. That window closed. So today, you know, the Russians are the critical players towards framing that longer term. And so that's you ask exactly the right question. The challenge is that we have to sit down with all of the parties, and by all the parties, the Russians, the Turks, the Saudis, the Iranians now who are on the ground fighting, the Shiite militias, the opposition, all of the parties, and of course Assad himself. There was a point at which Assad was more or less sidelined diplomatically, and the Russians have helped him get back in the game. And that's the real long-term strategic visibility and importance of Aleppo. If they capture Aleppo, which they're well on the way to doing, their goal is to secure Aleppo before the election, before the new administration takes place. The Syrians and the Russians have the two center seats at the table, and everybody else has to negotiate with them as opposed to around them. So I think you asked the right question, and what we have got to do is work with our allies to answer those questions in a concrete way.
Okay, very good. We have two people waiting in the queue to ask a question. Let's go to the next question now.
Well, it seems to me that our attempt to get rid of the only religiously tolerant leader in the area is misguided. And I was hoping that with the defeat of Hillary Clinton, we would not be wanting to go to World War III with the Russians, which seems to me a terrible inconvenience to everyone in the world. And that Assad's great crime is not having a Rothschild National Bank. So I'm not sure why we want to join forces with ISIS here and commit more deliberate murders against everybody who opposes them, everybody who they've subjugated, to enslave Christians and Jews and to massacre anybody who's not of the right flavor of Muslim. It seems to be a completely misguided effort, and I think we ought to leave the Russians alone, let them finish this.
Well, that's as I said, that's one strategic outcome here that's entirely plausible. That doesn't answer the larger question, is what is the United States' role in the region writ large? Do we have a role at this point? What should it be?
Well, it has been to destabilize the region, hasn't it?
In some ways, yeah.
I'm sure that's what U.S. policy is. That may be a consequence, but I want to just push back on maybe one of the underpinnings of your question, which is that the U.S. certainly is not joining forces with ISIS. There's a very complicated stew going on in Syria right now.
Well,
didn't
we spend millions of dollars to train three people who would be independent revolutionaries against Assad? And those were the only three people who would get interested in fighting him who were not in ISIS?
Well, no, there's actually quite a number of armed opposition groups fighting against Assad. In terms of the training, that certainly didn't necessarily play out as it was planned. That was not because
nothing,
there weren't...
Nothing the U.S. does is make plays out.
That was not because there weren't groups that were interested. It's because there were a number of restrictions placed on the training in terms of our ability to feel certain that folks we were training were going to conduct themselves according to the standards that we felt they needed to conduct themselves to, which is important, right? We don't want to provide our arms and training to groups that are violating the law. So,
what about the principle of first do no harm?
Well, that is, of course, that's certainly an important question. But we have been fighting against ISIS in Syria. We're not joining forces with them. The challenge is that there are a couple of rather large and nasty players in Syria. The two main ones are, of course, the Syrian regime and ISIS. What we have been doing is directly fighting against ISIS and at the same time supporting from many steps back the armed opposition groups that are fighting against the Syrian regime. The Syrian regime has used that opportunity to lump the armed opposition groups together with ISIS and call them all terrorists. But in fact, those armed opposition groups, they don't have much, if any, common cause with ISIS. You have other radical groups. You have 20, 30, 40, so many different groups whose allegiances have changed at various times. But at no time have we joined forces with ISIS or with the Syrian regime. And we have tried, not necessarily very successfully at times, to play two roles going on here at the same time.
And let me just add too, and I think Laurie's exactly right what she just said. The other premise of your question, which I should have clarified up front, when you said that the U.S. helped work to displace the secular regime, I'm not sure if you were. It sounded like you were referring to the Syrian regime, as opposed to Saddam and the secular Ba'athist Party in Iraq. You know, the problem is in Syria, that's been the Syrian regime's narrative: is that we're the protectors of the population and the ones fighting to preserve religious pluralism and religious tolerance. In fact, on the ground, nothing could be further from the truth. What the regime has done, Assad and his father have deliberately sought to create that facade. That's been their narrative, but it's false. I mean, Hafez al-Assad, when they conducted a widespread series of persecutions against the Shia or the Sunnis, used Christian militaries and Christian officers and Christian units to do that. The implicit message being, the only way you don't get Sunnis coming after you is to stay loyal to the Shiite regime, the Alawite regime. So it's a very complex dynamic on the ground. But I assure you, sir, that there is no interest in simply maintaining religious pluralism in the regime. What the regime cares about is its survival.
Okay, Mike, let's go to our last caller of the day with his or her question.
Hi, thanks for the discussion. I guess my comment is, doesn't any kind of accountability for, you know, what certainly appear to be a bunch of war crimes, doesn't that require either surrender, which is unlikely, or some kind of comprehensive military defeat, which also seems unlikely?
In the macro, yes, but remember, and you know, we could teach an entire semester of this. Lots of people do, me included. At best, we will not get comprehensive accountability for everybody. So even in a situation like Nazi Germany, when we have comprehensive defeat, there's no single mechanism that can handle everybody. So we do, you know, 22 Nazis at Nuremberg, great. And then we wash our hands and we say, well, we're done. Of course not. Real accountability comes when we reinforce the rule of law. And as we saw after World War II, as we've seen in the Balkans, you get international mechanisms with a small piece of it. You get thousands, by far the vast majority of war crimes cases are tried in domestic courts around the world, which has always been true in every single conflict. Some military commissions. So it takes a broad-based, comprehensive effort. You say comprehensive peace, you're right. But that's more, I think, a pragmatic necessity of getting the actual evidence in order to try these cases. But the legal ability is already there. The law is clear, and there are right now forums with jurisdiction, but they're insufficient. We need to expand that, and we need to have a plan with our allies. You know, my complaint about all this is we have allowed ourselves to be the victims, or to become victimized, if you will, in a strategic sense, because we've allowed the Russians to retain the initiative. And the greater fear, it may well be the case, as the previous caller said, that the United States' long-term interests are best served by decoupling our interests from what's going on in Syria. I would say that's absolutely not the case with respect to the integrity of the law. We cannot simply say what happened in Syria stays in Syria, because it has a bleed-over effect on all of the law of war. So we do have to create a comprehensive mechanism using all available forums to get at and prosecute these things. And it's possible, and we're just late to the game doing it. We're saying we want to do that, but as a pragmatic matter on the ground, we're doing very little to do it. And in doing so, the problem for us practitioners, and in long term, the problem that will then boomerang on the United States military, is that that delegitimizes the very law of war that defines the essence of professionalism under which they practice. To me, as an American and as a warfighter and as a West Point graduate, that is not acceptable. We have to reinvigorate and sustain the vitality of this body of law, because that's what allows us on the ground, the United States of America, to do our job, to do it professionally, and to do it properly. So I don't think in the legal regime, inaction is a viable alternative. And I toss it to Laurie to have the last word.
Well, I don't think I can top that. I would simply emphasize that it's essential to uphold the law and to fight to uphold the law. And we should remember that domestic law is not always perfectly enforced as well, and not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. The fact that we can't hold accountable every person who has committed atrocities in Syria should not stop us from trying to hold accountable even one person, and fighting for any possible way that we can do it, and also ensuring that the public discourse constantly hammers home the need to respect the law, to protect people even during the worst times of fighting and the most existential threats to a society. We have to retain our sense of humanity and morality and ensure that that we protect people and our values and our morals, because that's what we pass on to the next generation.
Well, Laurie and Mike, this has been excellent. We thank you very much for all of the good discussion today. I just want to leave with a programming note that our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow afternoon, December 2nd, at 1 p.m. That call will be a special Courthouse Steps edition discussing the recent Supreme Court oral arguments in Moore v. Texas. And we will have Kent Scheidegger, who is the legal director and general counsel at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, with us. But on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professors Blank and Newton for their time and expertise and for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.